Well, it's the first time I've ever spoken in a nightclub at lunchtime. In fact, it's the first time I've spoken in a nightclub at all. Now, the question Phil has given me is, does science point to God? And obviously I'm going to say yes. Otherwise, I don't think Phil would have invited me. And I'm going to argue, yes, science does point to God. It's the natural world is pointing us to a designing intelligence who is best described as God. The natural world is designed. And I'm going to argue that the evidence of science, like the video that's looping in front of us, is giving us evidence that the world is designed. Now, that's not something you very often hear a scientist say, and you might be surprised to hear me say that now, but let me reassure you that many scientists have said this. And here's three atheist scientists of the 21st century who said that very thing, that the living world does appear as if it's designed. So Julian Huxley wrote, "Organisms are built as if purposefully designed." Richard Dawkins, the well-known biologist and atheist, wrote, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." Francis Crick, who co-discovered the structure of DNA, wrote, "Organisms appear as if they have been designed to perform in an astonishingly efficient way, and the human mind therefore finds it hard to accept that there need be no designer to achieve this." So they're all saying to us, yes, the living world looks as if it's designed. Now, I'll come on later to how they still maintain their atheism in the face of that. But let's think about why they're saying the living world looks designed. Well, Richard Dawkins put it, "Biology is the study of complicated things. We see complexity, but not just complexity, that are designed for a purpose. We see around us complexity that has purpose." And if you think about your everyday life, whenever we see complexity that has a purpose, we tend to infer design. And Dawkins, Huxley, and Crick are all saying the living world shows that kind of complexity. So, for example, if you're out walking in the countryside and you see a wild flower, you pick the flower, and there you have an amazingly well-purposed, complex entity that is there to attract a pollinator, to put some pollen on it, to allow that pollen to be moved on the pollinator to another flower, and then for that pollen to germinate, form a pollen tube and go down and fertilise the egg of another flower. Amazingly complex design and amazing beauty as well. And when you think about it, a flower is often over-engineered for its task. It's more beautiful than it actually needs to be. If you watch a bee in a garden, it's bumbling around going to all sorts of different flowers. Some of them more beautiful than others, from our perspective. Some of them far more complex than others. It indiscriminately goes to all of them. So why do they need to be as over-engineered as they are? When we look at that kind of evidence, we think, well, this looks designed. For another example, if we look at this film that was made by a group at Harvard about the mitochondria, which are the power packs of the cell, this is at a nanoscale, which is far too small for a microscope to actually see. So this is a simulation of what science is telling us is going on. Here are some mitochondria. And as we look inside, we see various molecules, DNA and RNA, and various proteins moving around, all of them with highly complex structures that allow them to function as machines, which allow our bodies to work. Here's a membrane. Here's a pore through a membrane. There's a strand of DNA that we're passing, and various different subcomponents of mini molecular machines. And here is one of the most complex molecular machines that we have in our cells. We have trillions and trillions of these. It'll come back up in a moment. They're a tiny rotating motor which is driven by a flow of hydrogen ions across a membrane, which drives rotation, which itself induces a conformational change above that you can see there, which turns a molecule called ADP into a molecule called ATP. Now, that's called ATP synthase. It's turning a flow of ions across a gradient into molecules that carry energy around the cell. It's awe-inspiringly complicated. It's far more complex than anything we can make in our own nanotechnology. and we are literally packed with them, and so is all of life. And when we see things like that, we think, wow, that looks designed. It's very complex. It clearly has a purpose. Surely there must be a designer. And humans have thought that all through history when they've seen biological complexity. They've looked at the world around them and thought, wow, this must be designed. It must have a designing intelligence behind it, who is God. That idea wasn't really ever contradicted until the 5th century BC. There were a group of philosophers called the Greek atomists. And they said, well, maybe everything has just come about by chance. Maybe there are multiple universes, and we just happen to be in the universe that's been lucky enough to, by chance, have all this complexity coming about just spontaneously. And Socrates responded to them, and he said, well, let's look at a statue. And of course, at the time, a statue was sort of the height of human creativity. He said, look at the statue. Don't you immediately think, wow, the artist, the sculptor who made that statue must be very intelligent and very artful to have made a statue like that. Well, compare that statue, copying a human body, to an actual human body. How much more complex and purposeful is an actual human body? How much more intelligent and more admirable must be the person who designed and made the human body? So Socrates used that as an argument for the existence of God against the Greek atomists. And before that, no one had had to formally make that argument, as far as we're aware, because no one had contradicted the intuition that the world around us is designed. And Socrates' argument has been repeated down through the centuries and updated as human technology has got better and better. In the 18th century, people would point to a watch and say, well, look, we make these amazing watches. They point to design. So do the mechanisms of our bodies. And today, with evidence like this from molecular biology, that design argument, I would argue, is more powerful than it has actually ever been before. We can do nanotechnology today. We can make very simple things at the nanoscale, but nothing like this. And the contrast between the two, to my mind, is very powerful evidence for design in the natural world. But of course, Crick and Dawkins and Huxley, who I quoted at the beginning, don't actually believe that the natural world is designed. And why don't they believe it? Well, it's because of Darwin. Darwin claims Dawkins has explained away this appearance of design. The evidence may look strong, but since Darwin, we've known how we can explain it through natural mechanisms. And the Darwinian mechanism, as you'll know, is the mechanism of random mutation plus natural selection. It relies on tiny incremental changes so that step by step, a mechanism like one of these molecules in the cell, step by step, can improve. Every step has to have function. Every step has to be selected for it to be able to happen. And by a pathway, very slowly, we can gradually build up complexity. That's what Darwin told us back in 1869 in The Origin of Species. And as far as many scientists and as far as Dawkins, Crick and Huxley are concerned, Darwin has done away with the evidence for design. But I think we have to think very carefully about that, because this evidence for design is all around us, and we're continually finding in science fresh examples of design. And we have to keep asking the question, does the Darwinian mechanism really keep up with what we're discovering now in molecular biology and in the fossil record and throughout the sciences? So let's think first about flowers. I suggested near the beginning that these are something which appear to us to be designed. Well, Darwin wrote to the director of Kew Gardens in 1879 saying this: "The rapid development, as far as we can judge, of all the higher plants within recent geological times is an abominable mystery." The evolution of the higher plants is an abominable mystery. Why did Darwin say that? He said that because fossils of flowering plants suddenly appear in the fossil record in the Cretaceous. So quite late on in the fossil record, suddenly flowering plants appear from nowhere. Before that, we had coniferous plants and plants called gymnosperms, but we didn't have plants called angiosperms, the flowering plants, which are the vast majority of the plants you see around you. they suddenly appear in the fossil record in great diversity. Darwin knew that this pattern didn't fit with his theory of gradual evolution, and that's why he said it's an abominable mystery. Now you'll say, surely, since 1879 we've been able to solve that mystery. But actually, since 1879, our knowledge of the fossil record has grown immensely, and the sudden appearance of the flowering plants is still just as sudden today as it was in Darwin's time. And in fact, the mystery has got deeper, because Darwin thought that it was only the dicotyledonous flowering plants that appeared suddenly in the Cretaceous. Those are, as a big generalisation, those are broad-leaved plants and deciduous trees. He just thought it was the dicots, not the monocots. The monocots are things like grasses. He thought they were in the fossil record much longer, and so the dicots could have evolved from the monocots. But what we've discovered since then is the monocots also appear very suddenly in the Cretaceous. So not only is that a much bigger group of plants that we have to explain the origin of very suddenly, but also the thing that we thought that that explosion of things had evolved from is now part of the explosion. And so now we don't know what the flowering plants evolved from as their progenitor lineage. So Darwin's abominable mystery remains an abominable mystery today that is even deeper than it was in his time. How about things like these molecular machines? Well, of course, Darwin had absolutely no idea that these existed in his body. We've only known about the rotation of ATP synthase since 1997. So, of course, Darwin doesn't have a lot to say about molecular biology, but in The Origin of Species, he does say something which we can quite easily apply to systems like this. Darwin wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." He added, "But I can find no such case." Yet we have to ask ourselves, can we find such cases today with modern molecular biology? Complex organs that couldn't come about by numerous successive slight modifications. Well, I would suggest to you that looking at the structures inside our cells, and particularly these incredible motors like ATP synthase, it's very hard to see how they could have come about by numerous slight successive modifications. They have to have a lot of things in place before they can function at all. And we know with a complex machine that as soon as you start messing around with it, as soon as you start making random changes, it very quickly stops functioning. Very hard to imagine how these things could have come about by a Darwinian process. And indeed, no one has even imagined a step-by-step pathway by which these complex machines could have evolved. So is it really fair to say that Darwin has so demolished the evidence for design in the natural world that we can completely discount the idea that the natural world has a designer? I don't think so at all. I think the burden of proof is very heavily lying upon those who are claiming that Darwin has explained it all away. And the Darwinian mechanism, as far as I can see, is not holding up to the findings of modern science. And in fact, the evidence is getting stronger and stronger every day as we make scientific progress. So if what I'm saying is true, then there is evidence in science for God's existence. And the evidence is all around us every day. And also we ourselves, our own bodies, are evidence for God's existence. The design of our bodies is evidence for a superintelligence, otherwise known as God. Now, if that's true about God, then God isn't just about me and my feelings and my subjective experiences. God isn't just about events that happened thousands of years ago. The evidence for God isn't just found in historical documents. The evidence is actually all around me, and it's objective, and it's there for me and for everyone else. So that's the kind of God that, if he does exist, we really need to come to terms with, and we really need to think, if he exists, could he have tried to communicate with us? And if he did, what did he say? Thank you very much. Okay, these are some really interesting questions. So there's a few about... I haven't been making very good use of this mic. There's a few about Dawkins. So how did Dawkins, Crick and Co. explain the abominable mystery? And we've also got one. If Dawkins was here now, what would you say to him? I'll start with them. So Dawkins, how do they explain the abominable mystery? Well, there's essentially two strategies. One is to say the fossil record is wrong, and that it's an imperfect record of what actually happened in history. And the other approach is to say, well, there is an evolutionary mechanism that can explain very rapid bursts of evolution happening. So almost every feature that is unique to flowering plants has been suggested as a possible key feature that enabled them to suddenly start evolving really, really fast. So there's a lot of literature on that in scientific research papers. And then there have been lots of attempts to find flowering plant fossils from before the Cretaceous. And in every generation, there have been attempts made to and suggestions made of possible fossils. At the moment, there are some coming out of China which look as if they're Jurassic flowering plants. And some of the scientific community are very sceptical about that. Some are more positive about that. So there's a continual debate going on in the scientific community about what could explain the abominable mystery. But it hasn't been solved. There's still lots of different camps. It's still a hotbed of discussion. So there is no sort of unified answer to the abominable mystery. If Dawkins was here now, what would you say to him? I'd be more interested to know what would he say to me. I would very much like to hear what his response would be to this talk. Obviously, he wrote the book The God Delusion, and I think in that book he made some quite major concessions whilst very brazenly arguing against God. He admitted that he needs a lot of luck for evolution to work, and I think that's something I'd want to follow up with him. You know, how much luck do you really need to demand to get your view to actually be credible, you know? And to my mind, that is a leap of faith when he's saying, well, I need massive amounts of chance. So I think I'd probably want to push him on the faith commitment that he has in his view. Someone has asked, any evidence against the multiverse theory? And I bring that up now because one of Dawkins' arguments is, well, if I do need a lot of chance, maybe it can be provided to me by the multiverse theory that there are multiple universes. Very similar argument as the Greek atomists made back in the 5th century BC. So the question is, any evidence against the multiverse theory? I'd want to ask, is there any evidence for the multiverse theory? And could there ever be evidence for a multiverse, for universes outside our own? Because to my mind, science is about empirical evidence, things that we can actually test and prove. And I don't think that's true of the multiverse theory. So I wouldn't see it as scientific, I would see it as philosophical. And it seems to me the main reason why people invoke the multiverse theory is to try to get away from the idea of God. It's because the chances of our universe being able to support life appear to be so low, and that the chances of life actually appearing being so low by chance, that people are having to appeal to multiple universes to try and get the probability down to something that could actually happen. But in doing so, they're coming up with an incredibly extravagant and unprovable idea that there are multiple universes. And to my mind, it's more rational to believe in God than to believe in multiple universes for which we have no evidence. Was there a Big Bang? If so, what came before? I think the Big Bang is very good evidence in itself for God's existence. And people used to think that the universe was eternal, had always been here, was in a steady state. And when the first evidence came through that actually the universe was expanding and could have come through a Big Bang, there was a lot of resistance from atheists to that view. And it was only through a weight of evidence that they had to eventually admit, yes, a Big Bang probably was the start of the universe. I see that idea as very friendly to theism. What came before? Well, it seems surprising if nothing can explode into everything. To my mind, if God was before, that makes a lot more sense. Do you want me to take any questions from the floor at this stage? anyone has a question they didn't write, yeah.
We have one question. Why does complexity necessitate design? Why would we not look for a different answer?
Yeah. Well, complexity by itself doesn't point to design because, for example, if you're walking along the beach, the formation of the pebbles on the beach is complex. It's complex in that if you had to recreate that specific pattern, it would be a lot of work because everything is in a very precise place. But we know that natural processes and random movement of pebbles can generate the patterns of pebbles that we typically see on a beach. It's complex, but we know natural processes that can generate it. Where we really don't know natural processes that can generate it is when the complexity has a purpose, when it's a specified complexity. So if I'm walking along the beach and I see a row of pebbles and they spell out hello in the sand, I immediately think that must have been designed because that has a purpose beyond the pebbles. And I know that the action of waves isn't going to put them into the word hello. And so it's that complexity plus the specificity, the purposefulness that points to design. But that's what we're seeing when we look at the natural world. We're seeing complexity that has the purpose of things being able to live and enjoy life, survive, reproduce, etc. It all has a purpose. It's not just something that's come about randomly. Any other questions from the floor? Okay, I'll carry on through the list here. What was it that caused Darwin and atheist successors to come to the conclusion that evolution denied the possibility of a designer? That's a really good question because it's quite easy to see how you can have Darwinian evolution plus a designer. And indeed, that would be my view, that there is good evidence that Darwinian evolution does happen. But I don't think it provides a full explanation of how we and the world around us got here. So why do people want to push it further to say, well, its explanatory power is so great that it explains away design? I think really people had been and still are looking for something that enables them to deny the evidence for design. Darwin was very influenced by Charles Lyell, the geologist, who was a scientist when Darwin was fairly young. He took his works on the voyage of the Beagle and was posted new books by Lyell as they came out while he was on the voyage. And Lyell specifically said that he wanted to free geology from Moses. He wanted to move science away from the Bible. And Darwin and his successors were continuing in that general trend, trying to move science away from religion and from God as much as possible. And so to be able to come up with a theory that seemed to explain away biological evidence for design without needing God was a very attractive one, because that's the way they wanted science to head. And people like Thomas Henry Huxley at the time were really pushing that line. And I think for all human beings, the idea of being able to get rid of evidence for God is quite an attractive one, because God could have demands on us, and if we can rid ourselves of those demands, then we might feel that we're freer than we were before. Someone has asked, what is it like to be a Christian in an atheistic scientific world? That's a very interesting question. I would say that the scientific world is probably not as atheistic as you think. Lots of the prominent public communicators of science, like Richard Dawkins, are very strong atheists and make a big thing of that. But I find that there are a lot of scientists who I meet who are doing really good scientific research, not as well known as Dawkins and others, are much more friendly to the idea of design and much more open to it and much less willing to try and push their science towards an atheistic conclusion. They don't tend to get much publicity, and indeed to some extent they don't seek it, because there is an atheistic dominance in science, particularly in biology, and it can be costly to one's career to go against that. And I've been in a couple of job interviews where I thought I'd got the job, and then something came up about design, and everything changed, and I didn't get the job. So it's not popular with some of the gatekeepers of science, but in the grassroots of science, I think there's a lot more openness to these ideas than you might imagine. Do we have the right to genetically modify these intricate designs? Improving them, insulting to the designer? That's a great question. And it really depends whether or not you think that what we see in the world around us today is perfect, or whether the world around us is imperfect. So if you take a Christian view and you say, well, there's been a fall, and since the fall there's been degeneration and degradation, then maybe there is a place for genetic modification to try and get things back to a better state. If you take the view that everything is perfect at the moment, then I guess you wouldn't want to do genetic modification.
I think we need to draw stumps. So thank you very, very much. Thanks for all your questions. Thank you, Richard, especially for coming in to speak to us. Can I encourage you, if you do have questions, please do pursue them. Think about them, whether that's dropping me a line, or I'd love to help you think about how to pursue those questions, or chatting to Richard, he's going to stick around for a bit, or haranguing the person who brought you. We're here every week on Wednesdays, and we are thinking about these things together, so you'd be very, very welcome to join us. But thank you very, very much for coming, and hopefully see you again.